It's time again for the one show that takes a look at business from a different perspective. The Coaching Perspective with Master Certified Business Coach Doug Gefeller. Hey, Doug.
Hey, Paul. Glad to be here today in studio.
Yes, sir.
Well, welcome to today's episode of The Coaching Perspective. We're going to be talking about steps to a great strategic planning meeting. You know, I'm your host, Doug Gefeller. I've been a Master Certified Coach by the International Coach Federation since 1999, and I've been coaching business owners, senior executives, and their teams for 20 years here in Southern California, all under the banner of The Coaching Perspective. And during that time, I've been involved in a lot of annual planning meetings, and that's what I want to share with you today. If you'd like to know more about our coaching services, though, just go to my website, thecoachingperspective.com, or you can reach me the old-fashioned way, 714-726-8354. Well, let's get right into this. You know, every year, millions of businesses hold meetings to develop their annual plan. Some call it a budget, some call it a business plan, and some call it a strategic plan. I think it is critical to understand the differences between these plans prior to starting the planning process. So let's start off by looking at what I would propose as some definitions, some of which may be my own, but much of which is generally agreed to. A strategic plan. Well, a strategic plan very simply answers the question, how will I do it? And it's primarily used for implementing and managing the strategic direction of an existing organization. It's used to provide focus, direction, and action in order to move the organization from where they are now to that elusive point of where they want to go. The strategic plan is critical to help you prioritize resources, time, money, and people to grow the revenue and increase the return on investment, and we'll talk more about that. It's futuristic in nature. It's used to communicate the direction of the organization to the staff and the stakeholders. It identifies the steps and/or strategies that the business will use to meet, if not exceed, its objectives. The strategic plan can focus on the entire business, or it might focus on specific areas of the business, such as consumer marketing, customer retention, or product introduction. It analyzes the internal and external aspects that affect the business, and it outlines the specific steps needed to meet the company goals. Pretty inclusive. Well, then, what is a business plan? Well, where the strategic plan answers the question, how will I do it, the business plan answers the question, what do I want to do? And it's used to direct the operations. So rather than focus on just one specific area of the business plan outlines the entire operation and justifies the finances that are needed to maintain operations while forecasting the projected sales or revenue. While the business plan includes an overview of the business's marketing strategies, it generally does not include the additional strategies that are needed to achieve overall success. The key distinction between the strategic and the business plan focuses on the day-to-day operations. The third area, the third plan that is produced by many companies annually is the budget. And for some companies, that's all they do. Well, the budget basically is an accounting document. It is used to put numbers to the plans that we just talked about, the business plan or the strategic plan. It's used to measure the company's progress on a monthly and an annual basis by comparing the actual expenses or the actual revenue in different categories against the budget that was developed at the beginning of the year. Besides dealing with items on the profit and loss statement, it usually shows the impact of activities on the balance sheet and the cash flow reports. It may even include a listing of capital expenditures have been approved for the period. Well, those are the three basic kinds of plans that companies work on at the beginning of the year. Unfortunately, many companies don't distinguish between which plan they are working on, and that ends up causing a lot of confusion. I think it's extremely important that the plans be developed in the sequence that we talked about, starting with the strategic plan, moving from the strategy to the business plan, what do I want to do, and then moving to ultimately to the end product, the budget, which is how am I going to measure what I need and how I'm progressing. The objective in developing these plans is to get buy-in on the strategic direction of the company, both in total and also in specific areas first. Once you've got that, then the business plan can be created to achieve those strategic goals, and then finally, a budget that's, you know, calculated based on the plans. You know, I've done a lot of research on this, and the studies generally agree with the following. Most of the research shows that the following practices produce the best results from the planning process. Firms that plan every year or more often have a more aligned strategic vision and achieve better performance. At least annual plans is what it's saying. Longer retreats, in other words, firms that take at least, well, from less than a day to 3 days or more, contribute more to a shared vision but have little impact on performance. So let's dwell on that for a minute. What it's saying is that the longer your planning process, the greater the shared vision output is. But the longer planning process doesn't do anything to impact the ultimate performance of the company. It also says that spending 20 to 50 hours seems to be about the sweet spot for increasing performance. Much time beyond that isn't going to produce much in the way of results. Another key finding that is generally agreed on is that including what we're going to call rising stars, in other words, opening up the meeting beyond just the key executives in the company to those rising stars in the company, has a significant impact on increasing both the knowledge of the shared vision and also the performance of the firm. And this is a little self-serving, but firms that use an outside facilitator generally produce better results. Well, that's what the research shows or generally agrees to. You know, from my own experience, I've found a number of other things that I want to share with you today that I feel improve the planning process and the resulting performance. First is it's important to collect data that you need for the discussions, for the planning meeting, such as market information, analysis of the operations, the clients or the sales, and an employee input all before the meeting. So if, for instance, you're going to talk about who you're selling to and whether you're selling in the right markets, you might want to have your accounting or your sales department do some research so that they come to the meeting able to tell you these were our best customers, this is the demographics of those customers, this is how those customers found us, this is how often we have repeat business with them. All of that kind of information. So you want to collect that prior to the meeting. The other thing that I think is really key in my experience is to have at least two separate strategic planning meetings. The first meeting typically deals with marketing, sales, and public relations, those things that generally produce revenue. The second deals with the operations. But depending on the complexity of the company, this second meeting may be broken down into multiple meetings based on either profit centers or activities. So some companies that I've worked with, we have multiple second meetings, what I'm calling second level strategic planning meetings, one for each one of the divisions or one for each one of the subsidiaries. The other thing, and this is generally true of, or it's generally believed based on the research, is have the meetings off-site. Meetings that are held outside of the company offices generally produce more creative solutions and better results. They don't need to involve an overnight. You don't need to have a retreat where you go away for 2 or 3 days and you stay at an expensive hotel and that kind of thing. But you do need to get away from not only the daily routine, but the daily environment. It's hard to have creative discussions in the same conference room that you meet in 2 or 3 times a day all year long. So you want to go someplace else. You want to use an outside facilitator that generally produces better results. But prior to the meeting, it's important that the principals of the company meet with the facilitator to generally agree on a draft agenda of what you want to cover at the meeting. There's nothing worse for either the company principals or the facilitator to get partway into a meeting only to have them go, "That's not what I thought this meeting was all about." In my experience, it's also extremely helpful to have the facilitator produce the meeting notes and action lists that are distributed after the meeting. Now, this, as a facilitator, this is a task I'd prefer not to be involved in. I wish I could delegate it to somebody else, and at times I have. I've had a good administrative assistant there to take notes and document what was agreed to. But what I found was that when I have to prepare the notes as the facilitator and the action list, that what was written down during the meeting was a brief statement. And as I do the notes, I find I remember more dialogue that went along or more conversation that went along with that item. And I'm able to add it, and that makes it more meaningful. So while it's not my favorite task, I think it produces better notes and better action results. Flip charts, or a similar electronic display method of what is being discussed and what is being documented, will produce more interaction by the participants than using your laptop to record everything privately. And again, I've done both. I've sat there with my laptop and diligently recorded everything that was said, and I've sat there with flip charts or written on the whiteboards. You know, when people can see that you're writing down what they're talking about, one, they're more engaged. They feel like they're being listened to. And two, there is more opportunity for them to correct either what you heard or what they said. And I think that produces better results. Like any meeting, the meeting needs to start with a discussion on the roles that each person is going to play in the meeting and the ground rules. And what I mean by this is that especially the president or owners need to understand that their roles in these strategic planning meetings is that of just another participant, not as the deciding vote. Having said that, I've sometimes found it very helpful when we're in the middle of a discussion on something that's going in a direction that, based on my experience with the company, I don't think is going to be productive, to sort of take a time out and say, you know, let's stop for a second here. Let's get a reality check by having the president or the owners of the company, you know, what do you think of this idea? Is this something that is feasible? Is this something you're going to be willing to spend money on? Or is this something that we've just kind of got sidetracked and it's never going to happen? And, you know, when you can get a quick response immediately in the meeting, whether it's a yes, this is a great idea, let's go forward with the discussion, or whether it's, you know, there's no point having this discussion about ownership transition because I have no intention of ever transitioning any of the ownership to anyone else. I'm taking it with me. You know, then why waste time talking about it? So I think it's extremely helpful that the key executives understand their role, and that if you step out of that role, that you make sure that everybody acknowledges that, hey, we're stepping out of character for a minute for this specific purpose, and then we're going to step back into character. Ground rules. You know, the last meeting I conducted, I just pulled some of the ground rules that I had put at the bottom of the agenda to share with you as an example. One of them was that the suggested times on the agenda, and I like to prepare an agenda for these kind of meetings with each topic on the agenda has a time. So if we're starting at 8:30, we're going to discuss this item from 8:30 to 9:30 or 8:30 to 10:30, then we're taking a break. Then we're going to the next item, and that's from 10:45 to whatever. But I want to make sure that they understand the ground rules, that the suggested times on the agenda are basically not to exceed times, and that some items may be completed quicker. So there's nothing wrong with dealing with an issue quicker than we've projected, but it is a problem if we think we're going to go longer, because that suggests that there's not going to be enough time to cover the items that are later in the agenda. To help deal with that, I use the parking lot concept. This is a flip chart that's up on the wall labeled parking lot. And whenever ideas or discussions come up that are, you know, good ideas or good points that we want to discuss either today or in the future, but aren't key to the issue currently being discussed, I tend to interrupt and go, that's a great idea. Let's put that over here on the parking lot, and we're going to discuss that later. And then we make sure that either at the end of the meeting we cover the parking lot items or that we've identified that we didn't get to the parking lot items today. Those will be brought up, and we'll continue those discussions at our next regular management meeting. Another ground rule that I had on the agenda was that ideas may be questioned, but personal attacks aren't allowed. That seems pretty obvious, but it isn't. So I think it's important to put it there. A positive frame of mind will help you to develop creative thoughts. So let's develop an attitude of how can we support things that are being suggested rather than how can we sabotage them. Rather than thinking of all the reasons why we can't do something, let's focus on what we might do to help make that possible. And the last sort of ground rule that I had on my most recent meeting was your active participation, listening and talking, is needed for all items, even those that you are not personally interested in discussing. So no selective participation. No tuning out when we're talking about somebody else's area and not the one that you are responsible for. You know, again, just good meeting habits, but particularly important in a strategic planning meeting is that I found that breaks are often as productive as scheduled time in terms of producing ideas or getting participants to understand each other's ideas or positions and use them productively. In other words, I think the first step once we are into the meeting in a strategic planning meeting is to narrow down what topics we want to focus on and setting priorities. Meeting, we might want to use the following. So this is a sort of suggested list of topics that, you know, if you can't think of anything else, you might throw it up there and do it. The reason for this is that we could spend weeks talking about strategic plans for all parts of the company. The trick is to identify what are the areas where we have some current need to develop a new strategic plan or to reinforce an existing one, and what are the areas that if we were to spend our time discussing or developing new strategic plans, that they would give us the greatest return on our invested time and effort. So a suggestion might be, on this last meeting I did, I threw up on the board, do we want to talk about the purpose of the company? Do we want to talk about business development? Do we want to talk about strategies for organizational structure, project delivery, information technology, human resources, financial management, leadership transition, or ownership transition? And very quickly, the group was able to identify, you know, and we literally took a vote and we sort of expanded and customized this list to fit the particular company that I was working with. And then we went around the room and went, okay, give me your top two. Cast a vote for the top two. And very quickly, the number one and two items on the list were obvious and we had general agreement, whether they were all in agreement as to which was one and which was number two didn't really matter. They were the top items. Before we did that, I liked to sort of walk the group through how would we calculate a return on investment for some of these different areas. So for instance, and these are all for instances kind of discussions here, every planning meeting starts to automatically talk about how are we going to increase sales? Let's increase the revenue. As if that was the magic answer. Well, you know, as we look at that, in most cases, unless you're dealing with unless you're dealing with a factory that has unused capacity that carries no cost by putting it to use, generally increased sales produce the same margin that you got on the rest of your sales during the year. Unless you've got some reason that incrementally new sales are going to carry lower costs. In other words, the product or service carries a reduced per unit cost and there's going to be a higher margin. In those cases, the return could be substantially greater. Maybe it's a new geographic market or new types of clients or a new service that has a different margin associated with it. But so many times I see companies talking about and working very hard to increase the revenue from selling the same product or service they've been selling with exactly the same margin and expecting hugely different results. Another area that we sort of automatically gravitate to is the solution for any problem seems to be we need to hire more people. Well, what's the story when you hire more people, you know? Each new person produces only the difference between what they produce or what we bill them out at in the area of a service company, less their burden cost, what we pay them and the overhead that we've allocated to them, times their utilization rate. Since not everybody's 100% efficient, you have to figure out what their utilization rate would be. Also, additional staff requires additional support. They need another desk. They need more computers. They need more space. And more staff means you need to devote more management hours. So when you look at this, additional staffing, you know, isn't always the magic solution. It is only going to produce, much like the sales, an incremental, not hugely different result. Now, some areas that I found can have a significant impact are the following. For instance, if you talk about training of staff or improving or better defining the roles or reassigning the roles of the people so that the experts are working on what they are expert about, or that the people that are only producing mediocre results or less than totally efficient results are getting the training they need to do better, then the expected decrease in errors and the increase in the utilization or productivity from the training only costs us the training hour costs. Maybe somebody spending some non-billable or non-productive time training them, or maybe the cost of them going to an outside seminar, or maybe the cost of us purchasing some software to train them. So all of a sudden, we look at the fact that training and role definition or reassignments of staff can have a huge return on investment because the cost is so low compared to the results that you might get. Now, tie that into the fact that one of the greatest areas of opportunity for increased ROI is getting greater staff buy-in, or what some people might call improving the culture or the efficiency of the company. And the only cost for getting that is really increased management attention. You know, we've talked about this in the past, but let me just share with you some of the findings per the Gallup organization. When we start talking about buy-in, they said that the most recent research suggests that 29% of the U.S. workforce is actively engaged in what they're doing. Only 29%. 55% is not engaged in what they're doing, not totally engaged in what they're doing. And 16% is actively disengaged in what they're doing, whether that means they're deliberately working to sabotage what's going on in the company or whether they're doing nothing. What that means is that if 55% of all U.S. workers are not engaged and 16% are actively disengaged, then the math says that 71% of our workforce sitting there every day that we are paying for is not totally engaged in their roles. That means that we're operating at a third of capacity. A third of capacity. So stop for a moment and think, rather than hiring more people, if I can get greater buy-in by my employees on what we're doing, on their tasks, on their jobs, on their roles, if I can get them to be more focused and create fewer errors and be more efficient, then I have the opportunity to get two-thirds of a person back for almost no investment. Now, that is huge. So, you know, when we talk about engagement, when we talk about buy-in, when we talk about culture, and everybody rolls their eyes and says, oh, that's that sauce stuff that the HR department wants to talk about, happy time. Well, this isn't a company where we're going to have parties where people can dress the way they want, where they can decorate their cubicle the way they want, where they can walk around and have the hours the way they want. That'll never work. Well, you might want to talk to Zappos, and you might want to talk to Google and Apple and some of the other companies that have found that tapping into that portion of our workforce, that portion of each employee's brain that's not actively engaged in what we hired them to do, comes at very little cost. If you think about the fact that you can let them hang the pictures they want in their cubicle, or dress the way they want, or take some time to share what they're doing around the water cooler. You know, another area for increased return on investment of your time, which all of this analysis of what activities, what areas could we develop a strategic plan for that would give us the greatest return on investment. That's why we're doing this. So for those companies that are in a bid situation, that they are bidding for a job to either build something or provide services, you know, obviously if they could get higher margins, they would make more money. But in a competitive bid situation, higher margins might be very difficult to achieve. But what is more easily achieved is a more accurate definition of the project scope of what's going to be provided, along with really client buy-in in the sense that there is a clear understanding between your company and the client as to what is going to be produced for this proposal that is being submitted and awarded. What this does is it reduces those items that can't be billed, those activities that you work on that the client says, I never agreed to pay for those, or those things that you work on that were later deemed to be a mistake because the scope of what you were doing wasn't clearly defined. Now, all of these things, whether we're talking about revenue growth, additional staff, training of staff, or staff buy-in, those are things that this list needs to be sort of custom developed by the company and the facilitator to help identify what strategies, what strategic plans that we really want to work on. Once those areas of strategic plans have been developed, the rest of the meeting is really a piece of cake. It just starts to flow. Once you've arrived at the fact that, you know, okay, we've got a one-day strategic planning meeting, we've just spent 2 hours and we've identified the top four things that we want to develop a strategy for, and we've got a sort of two-sentence description of what our strategic goal is, then you get the group to assign priorities to them. What's the top 1, 2, 3, 4 items? And then you take them one at a time and you go through and you craft a more concise definition of what is the strategic goal here. What is the strategic goal that we want to do? If we're talking about increased project delivery, is the goal to get the clients to agree to later delivery dates, or is the goal to always be on time, or is the goal to be able to reduce the time we're now taking to do the work,
or is the goal to be more realistic in our initial proposals as to how long it's going to take us to do the work? Depending which one of those definitions you'd pick, you'd come up with a whole different strategic solution. So you decide which one it's going to be, and then you ask the group, okay, if we achieve this strategic objective, how would it show up? What would be different in the company? How would I see this? And you start to list the things or the ways in which you would see a change as a result of having achieved this strategic objective. This is a test. This is the litmus test that proves that, in fact, it's worth working on, that the items you're listing as being visible changes are really going to carry with them real improvements either to the bottom line or to whatever else you're trying to achieve in the company. And then the next step is, once you've got that list, is, okay, what are some of the areas that we need to work on in order to achieve these strategic objectives? Now, as the facilitator, there is a fine line that cannot be defined, that is sort of guessed at as you go along, as to what's the difference between a list of strategic actions that need to be taken and what is the business plan actions that we need to take that will help us achieve this strategic goal. The difference is in the detail. Very hard to define, but it's in the detail. If you start getting too detailed about, well, Jim is going to have to come in a half hour earlier, and we're going to have to get this other department to start a half hour earlier to support him, now we're starting to get into operational details that belong in the business plan, not in the strategic plan. But if the issue is, we need to get our sales force more familiar with the product limitations or the product specifications, those are strategies. How you do that is business plan. Do we take the sales force away and train them? Do we give them a manual? Do we give them an interactive webinar that we test them on their understanding of it? Those are all business plan steps to achieve the objective, which was to get our sales force to be more familiar with our product specifications, because that will achieve our strategic goal of being more competitive with in the marketplace by being able to better describe what it is we're able to do. You know, this is a conversation that could go on and on and on, but, you know, it's that time of year when everybody is working on strategy, business plans, or budgets, whichever you want to call it. And I felt it was important to just share for a few minutes what have I found to be in my years of experience useful definitions and useful steps that help you not only have a meeting, but have a great strategic planning meeting. And I think, just to summarize the key points here, you want to separate your strategic planning from your business planning from your budget. You want to get away and create an environment that encourages creativity. You want to identify strategy that is big picture strategy that is going to have a huge return on investment. And you want to prioritize and be realistic about how many of these things can I work on this year and how many do I have to relegate to the future. Once you've done that, then you can have a follow-up business planning meeting that says, now that we all understand our strategic objectives, what is the action plans that need to be generated to support that? And once you have those action steps listed out, then you know what this is going to take in terms of dollar costs, personnel, to achieve it, and the budget can be prepared. So, that's the step to a great strategic planning meeting. Thank you for listening today. If you're listening to the podcast, thanks for visiting our website, thecoachingperspective.com, or dgefellerpodbean.com. Be sure to check our archives for other shows, some great guests in the past. If you missed last week's interview, Leonard Simcheck was with us talking about writing naked. Wasn't exactly what I expected. Thank goodness we all kept our clothes on. but a great dialogue about how to let your true inner self flow from you to the paper. So be sure to listen to that. It's up on our sites, and you can hear it along with some of the other past shows. So this is Doug Gefeller. I hope that you've enjoyed the show today and that the discussion has provided you with new ideas and information that you can put to use immediately to identify and achieve your goals. Have a great evening.
You've been listening to the one show that takes a look at business from a different perspective, the coaching perspective, with Master Certified Business Coach Doug Gefeller.